We used the last hour constructively to demonstrate that Sam Harris's conclusion that Islam is the motherlode of bad ideas is accurate. Now, we could talk about why Islam is the motherlode of bad ideas for 100 years. But it really boils down to five events. There are five events that are crucial to Islam. And we've now presented four of those five. The first of them is Muhammad's initial revelation. That's the basis of their celebration of Ramadan. It's found in the 96th surah, where Muhammad, an illiterate man, was asked by the representative of his dark spirit in a cave to read a language that didn't even exist in written form. And the revelation provided was not only in the name of the Lord, which according to Yahweh, who happens to be God, is the identity of Satan, but it said that man was created from a clot of congealed blood, scientifically invalid. So inaccurate information provided in a wholly inaccurate scenario. No written Arabic. Muhammad himself couldn't have read it, even if the language did exist in written form, and it wouldn't for another 100 years. The experience is so horrific. The God and his spirit representative are so demonic. Muhammad attempts to commit suicide on the way back to Mecca. And then he admits that he's demon-possessed. That's the beginning of Islam. We move from there to through the never-ending arguments. And really, all of the surahs in Medina, or excuse me, in Mecca, Muhammad's first 100 surahs, are nothing but a never-ending argument, where Muhammad says that he is inspired by his Lord, which he calls Ar-Rahman initially, after the Syrian rock god. The Yemenite rock god. And that it's just Muhammad claiming, you know, I'm inspired by Allah, and he's just spewing out rubbish. And it's the Meccans, those who actually knew him best, saying, you're a complete fraud. You're a total charlatan. None of what you're saying is true. Well, we move through that, through the satanic verses, through the mythical wild-ass ride to the non-existent temple in Jerusalem, all piles of lies, to the single most important declaration in Islam. It's why the Islamic era, year one of Islam, begins with this meeting. And the pledge that initiates the Islamic era is the Pledge of Aqaba, whereby those in attendance promised Muhammad that on his behalf, that they would wage war against all mankind. That's the second most important event chronologically in the history of the Islamic religion. A declaration of war on behalf of Muhammad against all mankind. We move from there to Muhammad's treatment of three quarters of the population of Yathrib, today's Medina, where he took those practicing rabbinical Judaism and he annihilated them. He robbed them of their property. He decapitated the men. He raped the women. He sold the children into slavery. And he gloats over it, not only in the Hadith, but in the Quran. Allah says that he was a participant and enabled this horrific behavior. And that's actually the fourth event. I skipped over the third, excuse me. But the third is the event that actually established Islam's credibility, if you will, within Yathrib, today's Medina, and took Muhammad, who had been consistently viewed by everyone who knew him as a complete loser, and made some of the worst people in Arabia at that time motivated to follow him. And that was the terrorist raid that Mohammed launched against the civilian caravan at Badr. It is chronicled in the 8th surah of the Quran, a surah which says that stealing is lawful and good. Muhammad attacked a civilian caravan that was unarmed, had no army associated with it, was not attacking him. In fact, was heading the opposite direction. It had nothing to do with anything military, simply a group of businessmen. He attacked them ruthlessly. He laid in wait for them. He robbed them of their possessions. Those men that he killed, he mutilated, cut them into little pieces, and then gloated over their remains. Those that he did not kill, he kidnapped and held them for ransom. And then he distributed the booty that he stole amongst those who helped him commit armed robbery. Without that event, Islam doesn't have any followers. With that event, Muhammad was able to use the success at Badr to recruit additional followers. And that became the first of 75 terrorist raids that Muhammad would inspire and lead, motivating people to participate, the first Muslims, in these raids because they got a share of the confiscated booty and got to benefit in their twisted minds by raping the women, and they shared in the profits of enslaving the children. Moving through is annihilation of the Jews, which I covered out of order. We move to the fifth most important event in the formation of Islam, and that is the capture of Mecca. Muhammad, the previous year, came down with what he thought was insufficient mujahideen, insufficient jihadists, and he got cold feet. And though their intent was to conquer Mecca, he says no. And when the Meccans came out to defend themselves, he instead says, you know what I want to do is sign a truce. And he signed what's called the Pledge of Aqaba, where, not the Pledge of Aqaba, but the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. And the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, Muhammad had someone write that he would not terrorize the Meccans for 10 years, that he wouldn't rob them, that he wouldn't kidnap them, that he would not attack them, they would not enslave them, that he would leave the Meccans alone for 10 years. These were all behaviors that he was perpetrating on them, but then he signed his name that he, even denying that he was a prophet of Allah at the time, pledged that he would not attack them for 10 years. The ninth surah begins with Muhammad renouncing his vows. He came down against Mecca again the following year with more men under arms, more jihadists. And the Quran says that any treaty that is negotiated between Muslims and non-Muslims is not binding on the Muslims, which means that anything Allah said, anything Muhammad said, anything in the Quran, anything in the Hadith, not binding. You can't trust it. You can't trust a man who reneges on his signed oath. That's the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. It is the fifth most important act in the history of Islam. Now, there is an interesting side note to all of this between the fourth and fifth events. When Muhammad came down with insufficient jihadists to pummel the Meccans into submission, and his men didn't get the thrill of bloodlust, they didn't get the thrill of booty, they were unable to get the thrill of rape by attacking the Meccans, they turned on Muhammad, and Muhammad had to find prey in a hurry. And you see, the first tribe in Medina, the first Jewish tribe there, Muhammad didn't annihilate. He just stole their property and exiled them. Said, get out of here. You're no longer welcome. You have to leave. I know this has been your home for centuries. You're no longer welcome here. You get nothing. You just go out into the desert to die. We're taking everything that's yours. Kind of rings hollow when you hear the mythical people of the Palestinians claim that the West Bank is theirs under those circumstances. Well, they didn't die. They went to a farming community called Kabar, and they reestablished their lives as farmers there. So Muhammad, to satiate the bloodlust, the covetousness of the first Muslims, who were absolute barbaric scumbags, attacks Kabar. It's where the slogan Allahu Akbar was first stated, the Islamic prayer of fear. And it was screamed against the Jewish community of Kabar. And when they came out with their farm implements and saw Muhammad's mujahideen that had been insufficient in Muhammad's view to conquer Mecca, ready to terrorize them, Muhammad said, Allah is greater than your God. Their God, of course, was Yahweh, the only real God. And he not only terrorized the place, but Muhammad was sadistic. He tortured his victims. Muhammad got first pick as to which of the surviving women to rape, then let his men throw lots for who they got to rape, which is why the Quran condones rape. It's why Boko Haram commits rape. He then killed the men, enslaved the children, robbed them of all of their possessions. This is Islam. It isn't an interpretation of Islam. Those are the five most important events in the history of Islam. They are the events that are chronicled in the Quran and Hadith. And sandwiched between them, there are no good stories. There's nothing uplifting. There's nothing moral. There's nothing insightful. There's nothing revealing. There's nothing nurturing. Nothing. That is Islam. It is why the Islamic State acts as they do. It's why Boko Haram acts as they do. It's why there's no fixing this religion. It is the mother lode of bad ideas. So when the President of the United States chooses, rather than just ignoring Islam, which would have been inappropriate since he's declaring war on the Islamic State, which is the most accurate expression of Islam on the planet today, would have been inappropriate to declare war without mentioning the motivation of those that you're at war against, chose instead to lie about Islam at the United Nations, saying that the Islamic State was not Islamic, saying that there's no association between Islam and the activities of the Islamic State. Nor, in fact, he went so far as to say there's no connection between Islam and terrorism. Now, he could have just ignored Islam, where that would have been inappropriate. It's vastly more inappropriate to deliberately lie about the religion, which he did. He knows every word that coming out of his mouth is untrue. So he continues with these words. He says that, second, it's time for the world, especially Muslim communities, to explicitly, forcefully, and consistently reject the ideology of Al-Qaeda and ISIL. Now, first of all, there is no ISIL. There never has been an ISIL. There's an Islamic State. Now, he has jumped by saying the ideology of Al-Qaeda and, let's use the correct term, the Islamic State. He's inferring that their ideology, that they have an ideology. I mean, that, and he's, by saying that Muslim communities should reject the ideology of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State, he is explicitly inferring that the ideology of Islam and the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda differ. And that the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda not only have an ideology, it's different than the ideology of Islam, and that it is common between them. Every aspect of that is false. Neither Al-Qaeda nor the Islamic State have their own ideology. and the ideology of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State are fundamentalist Islam. You could not differentiate the ideology of Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, or Muslims. They're the same. The Islamic State is the purest, most accurate manifestation of Muhammad and the Islamic religion that he conceived on planet Earth today. They are not only Islamic, they are the most accurate manifestation of Islam on planet Earth today. Everything that he said in this statement is inaccurate and misleading. He went on to say, it's the task of all great religions to accommodate devout faith with a modern multicultural world. Say what? No, it isn't. It isn't the task. First of all, there are no great religions. There are large religions. Religion is never great. And Islam is the second largest religion. Christianity is the largest religion, and the third largest religion would probably be Hinduism, although I consider socialist secularism, humanism, if you will, a religion of man. And under that basis, it is probably the largest religion today because it is the religion of political correctness. It's the national religion of America, the national religion of most European countries, combined that with the communist and atheist nature of China. And I think that you can make the argument that the largest religion today is actually socialist humanism. But it isn't the task of any religion to accommodate a multicultural world. Now, this is the stupidity of that coexist bumper sticker that so many morons put on the back of their car. Islam is an overt declaration against all non-Muslims, saying that all non-Muslims must either surrender to Islam, be killed, or be treated with abject humility, that they must be so degraded that death is a better alternative. So Islam has never and will never, based upon its own scriptures, accommodate a multicultural world. It's opposed. Its very existence, the Pledge of Aqaba and the Quran, its very existence is opposed to multiculturalism. The religion of Christianity, based upon Pauline doctrine, you either accept Paul's testimony as true, or he condemns you. And he's savage about it. He not only wants you condemned, he wants you killed. Christianity is not multicultural, never will be. Pauline Christianity is extraordinarily narrow. We'll be back. If you consider the religions of man, communism, socialism, atheism, humanism, they're wholly intolerant. Let me give you some examples. The German National Socialist Worker Party, known as the Nazis, they were not only intolerant of Jews and Christians, but also of communists in Russia. Totally intolerant. The communists in Russia were wholly intolerant of the National Socialist German Worker Party, the Nazis. Kill them by the tens of millions. And those they didn't kill, they tortured and imprisoned in horrific ways. Both of them raped each other's women. When you look at the inability to adapt to a multicultural world of someone like Pol Pot, a communist, it's pretty disgusting. If you look at Islam's attempts today in Syria, even to get along with fellow Muslims, there's no multiculturalism. None. Every time that Islam has an opportunity to demonstrate multiculturalism, it murders those that are different. Every time that communism and socialism, the religion of man, has the opportunity to demonstrate multiculturalism, they're murderous. What happened in Russia to those individuals who would not submit and surrender to communism? They were hauled away to the gulags, tortured, worked to death. This notion that there is tolerance, look at it, Christianity's birth. It began by being wholly antagonistic towards Jews. You read the rhetoric of the first Christians, it make your toes curl. I mean, it's worse than what you read in the Quran. And then as the religion developed around the time of Constantine, they became intolerant of anyone holding a different view of Christianity than did the emperors. People were hunted down and killed for a different theology. Christianity has never been multicultural. Islam has never been multicultural. Judaism is devoted to a race. It has never been multicultural. Communism has never been accepted of multiculturalism. The Obaminator's statement is 100% the inverse of the nature of these very doctrines. Rather than being the task of great religions to accommodate devout faith with a modern multicultural world, it's exactly the opposite of that. So why would he lie? Why would he say things that are untrue? He says no children anywhere should be educated to hate each other. Well, they were educated to hate in early Christianity and still in Christian communities like those in Greece, where 90% of Greek Christians are anti-Semitic. It holds true today. But in Islam, all Islamic schools teach Muslims to hate Jews universally. So whether or not he says that no child should be educated to hate other people, the fact is that it is ubiquitous today in Islam. There is no way to disassociate hate mongering and hateful education and Islam. It's universal. You will never find a good Muslim who is tolerant of Jews or Israel. They've been indoctrinated their whole lives to hate them. So then he goes on to say there should be no more tolerance of so-called clerics who call on people to harm innocents because they are Jewish, Christian, or Muslim. Well, he strung these three things together to make it sound like there are clerics out there that are telling people to go harm Jews and Muslims. And if there are, they are so remote as they don't even justify a mention in a speech like this. The only clerics that are calling on people to harm innocents are imams, Islamic clerics. And they are telling, and that's why this should have said, no more tolerance of so-called Islamic clerics. But he didn't say Islamic cleric because he wants to make it sound like that you know, all religions share accountability here. It's not true anymore. There's only one religion that is calling on its faithful to go off and kill anyone who is Jewish, Christian, agnostic, atheist, or Muslim of a different persuasion. Only one. So tell it truthfully. Make the point, if you're going to make the point, say that we should be no more tolerance of Islamic clerics. But how can you say there should be no more tolerance if your previous line was that all great faiths accommodate a multicultural world? That's total tolerance. And in your very next line, you say there should be no tolerance. You know, if this were evaluated on a rational basis, you'd say he just contradicted himself. But contradictions are accepted in today's world. That's the basis of political correctness. Total and complete contradictions. That's the reason why the University of Virginia students marched saying, I'm intolerant of intolerance. Here's this man saying, you got to be tolerant, multicultural. And then in his next line, no more tolerance. We have Tommy, who's called in from North Carolina. Hello, Tommy.
How you doing, Yada?
You're doing great.
One of the things that I've noticed is about these, the masses of people don't find the source of their religion because the majority of them don't practice and they don't even read their religious books. They just listen to their pastors and their imams. And then they just go about their business. You know, like after church on Sunday, we would just go eat some fried chicken and have a picnic. But we never actually verified that the pastor was telling us what he was actually going to lead us to God. And myself, I found that when I practiced Christianity, I found the God of Christianity, and I didn't like him. And my option was burn in hell or love him. And I was torn. I didn't like it.
You know, the number one reason that thinking individuals are opposed to Christianity and become agnostics. That is the number one reason, is that thinking individuals, rational individuals who actually think their way through the process say that a God who would tell us, love me or I will see to it that you're tortured in hell forever, isn't lovable. And so what you discovered is that because Christianity says you either go to heaven or hell, and that you go to heaven if you choose to love the Christian God, otherwise he sends you to hell, that God not only isn't likable, he most certainly isn't lovable, that God is sadistic. So you actually discovered by thinking the Christian God, and the Christian God's repulsive.
Well, I didn't think I had an option for quite a few years, and then in fact, just kept pursuing and kept, you know, learning truth about history, and then I found out that the Torah was God's only testimony, and then when I found out what his name was, and I learned his path, and you know what, I actually, you know, I have four children, and I can present this path to them, and it's not sadistic, and it's fun, right. And the God of the Torah is very lovable. And
isn't that true? I lovable is a wonderful term, but beyond all of that, I think you have to start at a simpler level. He's likable.
Yeah, I liked him first.
I like him. I really like him. Yeah, I actually do. I like him. I mean, I like how he reaches out to us. I like what he has to say to us. I like how he approaches us. I like what his expectations are of us. I like what he has to offer us. And I like the whole process of getting to know him. I like him. I mean, it's his character, his persona, his way of working with us and being approachable. He's just flat out likable.
Yeah, and in the Christian path, it seemed very hard to find the person, and then
yes,
I would also become angry there. And then, like I said, when I became to know Yahweh, it was frustrating at first, but then after I found the path, it seemed like it was rewarding. It wasn't super easy, but it wasn't super hard either.
Yeah.
But it was in a way like, wow, man, I found the reason that I was put on this planet. The whole reason this universe exists, I found it.
Right. And it resonates. The truth really does resonate if you're willing to invest the time. It's so weird to say, you know, I'm going to worship this God that's no bigger than a man. That men were able to kill. And the most common pictures of him are either in his mother's arms, where he's just, you know, goo goo gaga, or nailed to a pagan cross. And we're supposed to worship him? I mean, why would you want to worship a god that's no bigger than a man that men could kill?
Why would you want to do that for eternity anyway? You know?
Oh, God, can you imagine just to go one step further, which is what you're suggesting here. How would you like to spend eternity down on your knees in worship? Why would you even want to know a God that wants to be worshipped? Can you imagine a God so insecure that he would conceive a being for the express purpose of worshiping him?
I can't imagine.
What a revolting individual. I mean, it would just be that such a God isn't appealing. It's that God is revolting. You know, one of the things that you said is resonates. My youngest son went to a Christian college for a couple of years because of the chemistry program there. Chemistry program was really spectacular at this school. But to graduate, he had to take their religious classes. And he is overtly anti-religious. And so in one of the classes, they had a professor for 1 year that actually used Yahweh's name. That used Yahusha's name. That spoke of the truth about Paul. And, of course, he didn't stay the second year. They drummed him out. But and my son, you know, he was just that was more fun for him than anything in the world because he knew these things. So one day the professor, as Blake was explaining various stories in the Torah, prophets and Psalms and how they relate to Yahusha, and my son knows the story. I mean, he's read the Torah, prophets and Psalms cover to cover probably 20 times. And so the professor said, "So how many of you? These are Christians in a Christian school." Have read the Bible. Actually read it. 3 hands out of 60 were raised. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Tommy, who's called in from North Carolina. Tommy's point was that most Christians haven't a clue what it means to be a Christian. And if the fact is, I think you're inferring one step beyond that, which is if they actually read with an open mind the source material of Pauline Christianity, which would be Paul's letters, because Christianity cannot be based on the two eyewitness accounts, and not even remotely. So it's based on Paul's letters. That if they were to read those with an open mind, they would reject the religion.
That's right. And the other thing that's really scary is, like, for myself and like you and others, you know, once you find the source of Christianity, I, of course, rejected him. And then, you know, just like Yahweh said, he gives us a choice to choose him. I chose him. Right. And what's really scary, when I heard you talking about Jerry Falwell and the other TV evangelists, that it's sickening. My stomach turns in knots to think that my pastor would actually meet the adversary and lead with him.
Yeah. And the majority of Christian pastors know what they're saying is untrue. The overwhelming majority. The overwhelming majority
know
that Lord is
a lot smarter than me. My pastor is a lot smarter than I am, and if he can't see it, he's got to be playing a game.
Oh, they are playing a game. Majority of pastors know that there was no Jesus, there is no Christ, that the names are completely bogus. They know that Paul contradicted the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. They know that he sought to annul them. They know that Yahusha affirmed the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. They know that Yahusha was Torah observant. They know the truth. And yet they promote the lie. They know that Christmas and Easter and Sunday worship are all pagan. They know it, and yet they celebrate them. They know that their so-called New Testament has more errors in it, more inconsistencies with the oldest manuscripts than there are words. And yet they hold up their Bible and said this is the inerrant word of God. And yet they know that more than half of their New Testament is in absolute conflict with the Torah, and they say that both are the word of God, even when they say the opposite things. And so there is no way that they could have received an education in college on these things and be unaware of the conflicts. So they're deliberately misleading. They're doing it for money. They're doing it for fame. They're doing it for popularity, for honor, for whatever reason. But they know it's not true. Jerry Falwell knew that the religion that he was promoting was untrue. And I spent hours and hours with him. He knew it was untrue. He knew Christmas and Easter in church had no basis. And yet he knew that if he told the truth, that he would no longer be popular, that he would no longer raise the money for the school, that he would be labeled a kook, and so he chose to continue to deceive. Nice fellow.
Yeah, my pastor's really nice, and I spent a considerable amount of time early on thinking that I might would be able to, you know, I was naive to think that, you know, maybe the people at my church and maybe my pastor would want to know these things, and I would send very thoughtful emails. I would write papers, and I would get a two-sentence response saying, you know, they don't know what to do with that. Eventually, I just got ignored, and now I get zero response, and I get the fake.
No, they don't want to know. Yeah, they don't want to know. For years, when I was beginning to write Yada Yada, I thought, you know what, I've completed Yada Yada. I need to give a copy to Jerry Falwell, because we were friends, and I really loved the man. He was just a really likable guy, and he was obviously misled and misleading, and I figured, you know, if you took a guy like this and you always had hope that they would embrace the truth and then promote the truth, and how marvelous that would have been if a person with his access and notoriety were to reject the lie and embrace the truth, thousands of people would listen. And so I always thought that's what I wanted to do most. And he died before I finished Yada Yada, but the reality is, would have made no difference. He would have rejected it out of hand. He would have agreed that everything in it was true. He wouldn't have tried to refute any of it. In fact, he would have acknowledged every bit of it's true. It's just that he wouldn't want to deal with it. And that's the case of every Christian. The Christian is very much like the person listening in the United Nations to the Abominator say that the task of all great religions is to accommodate devout faith with a modern multicultural world. In other words, to be tolerant. And then in his next line to say there should be no more tolerance of so-called clerics who call upon people to harm innocents because they're Jewish, Christian, or Muslim. A direct contradiction of what he said in the previous statement. And with most people, they're incapable of recognizing a contradiction.